Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Karen Landon. A lot of the people listening today are probably too young to remember Phyllis Schlafly. She was a Reagan-era conservative activist who died in 2016 at the age of 92. Now, early in her career, she was pro-segregation, and later on, she was anti-feminist. But in 1982, not long after the publication of one of the first studies describing a school-based sex ed program's success in reducing teen pregnancy, she said, quote, "Sex education is a principal cause of teenage pregnancy." Today, we might call that statement fake news, but back then, the New York Times coyly said that her findings, quote, appear to be more a matter of revelation than research. Now, this was all part of a drama that had been playing out since the 1960s, when conservative and religious groups first started arguing in earnest that school sex ed encourages sexual behavior in young people. Schlafly made her statement right at an important turning point for opponents of sex ed. In the mid-1980s, HIV emerged as a very real threat to sexually active people everywhere, and folks aligned against sex ed took the opportunity to advocate for abstinence-only education. And they got a lot of money for their trouble. First in 1981, then with an expansion of funding in 1996, and again in a really big way in 2004. Congress is still funding a lot of abstinence-only education today. Since these programs first began, more than $2 billion taxpayer dollars have been spent on abstinence-only sex ed programs in the country's public schools. Currently, about a third of American adolescents are getting abstinence-only sex ed in school, and in Georgia, the number's probably somewhat higher than that. That's despite an exhaustive body of data demonstrating that abstinence-only education is one of the worst ways to actually prevent teenage pregnancy, transmission of sexually transmitted infections, and overall sexual health. In fact, last August's Atlanta Journal-Constitution, there was an expert on school sexual education who wrote that Georgia's abstinence-only programs endanger students. That expert is joining us today to help us understand what's so dangerous about abstinence-only sex ed and why so many of Georgia's public schools use it anyway. Andrea Swartzen-Druber is an assistant professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of Georgia's School of Public Health. Also with us are a parent and a former student from Gwinnett County, where a battle to change their public school sex ed policy is heating up. Jamie Winfrey is a co-founder of Gwinnett Citizens for Comprehensive Sex Education, and Laura Anderson is a 2011 graduate of Brookwood High School. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to clarify that Aunt Andrea is here representing herself and not the University of Georgia in any way. So, Andrea, I'd like to start with you. Can you help define our terms? What are we talking about when we talk about abstinence-only sex education? And what is its alternative, this comprehensive sex education?
So abstinence-only sex education promotes that sex outside of the only sex within the context of marriage as the only acceptable standard of sexual activity. Comprehensive sex, and so by teaching only abstinence of marriage is a way to avoid adverse sexual and reproductive health outcomes like STDs and pregnancy. The curricula does not promote at all contraceptives or instruct students about ways that they could reduce their risk for adverse sexual and reproductive health events. On the converse, comprehensive sex education teaches about abstinence as a way to prevent as a best method for avoiding STDs and unintended pregnancy, but also teaches about condoms and contraception as ways to reduce risk of STDs, of pregnancy. It also teaches about interpersonal communication and relationships, helps people, young people, explore their own values and goals and options.
Okay. So I'm guessing a lot of listeners out there are thinking, well, you know, okay, so in school you're exposed to abstinence-only education, which sort of focuses on preventing kids from having sex outside the confines of marriage, waiting until they're married, abstaining until they're married. You know, but they get all their information from outside sources, or a lot of other information from outside sources, right? From other kids, from the internet, from their parents. why is this such a big deal? Why does it really matter so much if a school's sex ed program is abstinence only?
The abstinence-only based curricula have been criticized in a number of different ways and for a number of different reasons, of taking a values-based, moralistic approach to teaching young children and neglecting particular populations of young people. For example, with an abstinence-only approach, it neglects the students who are currently sexually active and does not help them reduce their risk. And we know, at least nationally, about 40% of high school students have ever had sex, and about 30% of high school students have had sex in the past 3 months. So there are youth out there who have risk today. And so it's not an appropriate approach or curricula for students who are currently sexually active.
So it's bad for kids who are sexually active. It kind of makes them feel bad about their decisions to that point.
Well, not only makes them, I wouldn't say next doesn't make them feel bad, but it does not promote reducing risk behaviors. For example, comprehensive sex education curriculum, the evidence, a large body of evidence shows that it delays initiation of sexual activity, that it increases preventative behaviors such as condom use. It reduces risk behaviors such as having multiple partners. It also has been shown to prevent pregnancy. So the large weight of the evidence shows that comprehensive sex education curricula actually are effective in reaching our public health goals.
So, yeah, Jamie, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that absolutely, what Andrea says is true, but I would reiterate what you said, which is that it does cause harm emotionally as well. Our organization started a petition in November. We have about 1,200 signatures, and a lot of those signatures are from current or former GCPS students. And we have signatures from students all over the county, from many different years experience within the school system. And a lot of these kids have said, you know, I was sexually abused prior to having this class, and all it taught me was that I was used up and worthless. I had already had sex, and so I figured there was no point in not have, you know, I just continued to have sex with more people because the program said I was already worthless. So what difference does it make? So there's a lot of emotional harm that goes forth as well. And also to LGBT students who the curriculum doesn't even mention their existence. And we've heard from many LGBT students who say, you know, I didn't even know what safe sex meant in this context. And I still don't know, because they completely ignore my group within the curriculum.
So it sounds like it not only makes kids feel bad about the kinds of encounters, whether voluntary or involuntary, that they've had prior to the sex ed class. It's also a missed opportunity to share life-saving information that could help them prevent pregnancy and prevent STD and HIV acquisition, not just during high school, but also as adults. I think, Andrea, in one of our previous conversations, you mentioned that, you know, kids who learn safe sex in high school go on to practice safe sex as adults.
Yeah, so there was a recent new study out that looked at attitudes towards contraception among adolescents, and then looked at actual use of contraceptives in adulthood. And what they found is that individuals, young people who had more favorable, better attitudes about contraception tended to, were more likely to use an effective method of contraception as adults and used them more consistently. So what you think and what you learn and the attitudes that you form in adolescence actually do affect adult health in many ways.
Right. So, and also, Jamie, as you mentioned, the additional problem from that can result from having an abstinence-only approach is that kids who are excluded from that narrative of, you know, getting married to a person of the opposite sex, it's another opportunity for them to feel like they don't fit in and like they don't belong.
Right, and LGBT students are not the only ones who don't end up getting married.
Right.
To underline this, I'd just like to read one student statement from our petition that says, "My sex education was not only factually lacking, but psychologically debilitating at Grayson High School. It affected me into my adulthood, physically and emotionally, and I hope that going forward, the youth of Gwinnett County can be provided with correct information about their own sexual health and how to care for it, rather than misogynistic and religious-based ideas of sex."
And Laura, you wanted to add something to that.
Well, it's ironic as well, because in the Choosing the Best Way, this is for sixth graders, and I have the teacher's instructional book, they do kind of a CYA by saying that it's universally applicable and inclusive, and that although Choosing the Best does not reference sexual preference or gender identity directly, the programs contain universally applicable principles that are designed to help all students avoid sexual risk and so on. And a few students that we've worked with have even said, you know, they're of the LGBT group themselves, and they've asked the teacher or the instructor, how does this apply to me? And they just very dismissively say, oh, it applies to everyone. It's fine. It's a blanket statement. And that's their way of kind of excluding it without excluding it.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that specific curriculum later, but I'm sorry, Andrea, there was something else you wanted to say.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, within any school, there are particularly vulnerable students. And when you look at HIV rates, for example, in the state of Georgia, and STD rates in our state, they're extraordinarily high. And some of the students who are perhaps most vulnerable often aren't getting what they need.
Yeah. So in the minute before the break, Andrea, can you tell us really quickly how these programs differ in their ability to achieve their goals? And really, before you answer that, can you tell us quickly what the goals are of high school sex ed programs?
Yeah, so the goals would be a bit of what you've already explained, of providing a foundation for students that would carry them, you know, through the health and promote their health through their lifelong. Many of the programs have a goal of either delaying sexual activity or reaching some of our public health goals, which would be increase in preventative behavior of using contraception if at risk, of using condoms if at risk as well. So those are some of our public health goals. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten the question.
So how are these different? Does one kind of sex ed do a better job of achieving these goals than another kind?
The evidence is extraordinarily clear that comprehensive sex education curricula do delay sexual activity, that delay frequency or reduce frequency of sexual activity. They actually prevent teen pregnancies. Comprehensive sex education has not shown to do its primary goal. It does not delay sexual activity.
You said comprehensive. I think you meant abstinence only
based does not achieve its goal of delaying sexual activity. There's been a lot of studies, a lot of evidence, and the evidence is clear.
Okay, great. We're going to go to a break right now. We'll be right back with more.
Tune in every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on Rec Radio 91.1 FM or on rec.org for Battleground, a wrap-up of the week's news hosted by Asia Nicely.
Every Thursday on Lost in Oscillation from 7 to 8 p.m., I showcase the best in local and international minimal synth, EBM, and archival releases. You can tune in on WRAK 91.1 FM or WRAK.org/listen.
Welcome back to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Karen Landman. Today we're talking about how Georgia's sex ed misses the mark and what communities can do about it. I'm speaking with Andrea Swartzen-Druber, a professor at the University of Georgia School of Public Health. Andrea, do we know what parts of the nation and what parts of Georgia use what type of sex ed program?
So if you mean individual curricula, I don't necessarily have that information. In Georgia, comprehensive sex education curricula approaches are really quite low. There was a report put out by the CDC in 2016, and I don't have the exact figure off the top of my head, but I think it showed only about one-third of high schools high schools in Georgia actually taught all 11 recommended sexual health topics. So comprehensive sex education in Georgia is actually quite low.
I see. You showed me earlier a map, a few maps put together from data that had been gathered, I think probably by a combination of CDC and the Guttmacher Institute, showing which states have certain policies about requiring the teaching of HIV prevention information in their schools, STI prevention information in their schools, contraceptive information in their sex ed programs in public schools. And I was sort of surprised by how it's not a regional map. You know, there, New York State, there's one, I forget exactly which of those is not required in New York State, which I think we kind of expect to have a more comprehensive approach. I think California may be one of the few states that actually requires a comprehensive sex ed approach in their public schools. But otherwise, it seems like, you know, states are all over the map. And in Georgia, you know, I understand that about half the counties use an abstinence-only, a particular abstinence-only curriculum, but we don't really have a clear idea of which counties are using any abstinence-only curricula and which are using a comprehensive sex ed curricula. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that that's true. There's no easy accessible place, publicly available place where one could see, you know, which school boards are using which type of curricula or which type of approaches.
Yeah, okay.
You know, speaking to that nationwide map, our organization, we've received phone calls, we've received emails, we've received Facebook messages from other groups like ours in Missouri, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania, in New York. This is a nationwide problem. It's not just Georgia. There are parents like us fighting to get rid of these horrible abstinence-only curricula all over the country.
So one of the curricula that is used pretty frequently is called Choosing the Best. We've referred to it briefly in the previous segment. And about half of Georgia schools use that curriculum. Andrea, can you tell me a little bit about the program? For example, where it's used and how it's been rated for accuracy.
So it's used in, as my understanding, in over 20 states in the country. It's used throughout Georgia. It's used in Gwinnett County as well. It's been largely criticized as, you know, instead of choosing the best, it's actually been criticized as being the worst of the worst in terms of by public health practitioners and people who have reviewed the curriculum, specifically in terms of accuracy of information being a bit misleading in some of the facts or how they present scenarios. There was the state of Washington and the Department of Public Health and Board of Education reviewed various curricula, scaled using a CDC tool, you scaled the curriculum on various measures and gave Choosing the Best a 0 for accuracy, meaning the worst of the worst of the lowest scores.
Wow, that's pretty dramatic.
You know, I'm having a flashback to my high school experience. I'm 45 years old, so high school was late 80s. And I don't remember there being any sort of question about whether there'd be abstinence-only education or comprehensive. We were in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. There were all kinds of videos and shocking bits of revelation for me. Is abstinence-only something that has come up recently as a strategy, or has this been going on for a long time and I just didn't know about it because I was somewhere else?
Yeah, as Karen stated, it even in the early 1980s, there was federal funding for abstinence-only based curricula. And then in 1996, there was a large increase in funding at the federal level that continued at a very rapid increase until about 2006. People have been producing lots of evidence. There are many, many studies, and there have been reviews of the reviews of the studies even. So there's a large wealth of evidence regarding abstinence-only based approaches and comprehensive approaches.
And that dumping of the money, did that really get it from very little to prominent? Was it sort of, it wasn't around and then it was funded, or had it been going on and then it got a boost from the funding?
it definitely got an increase and restricted other types of approaches.
Okay.
Yeah. So also, I think, Charlie, the initial wave of funding in the early 80s was made to community groups and faith-based education, so not to public schools.
Right.
The 96 wave of funding was to state budgets for public education.
Yeah, see, I had gotten out by then.
That's why you know so much. All right, so Andrea, thanks for that. Let's talk a little bit more about that choosing the best curriculum. Can we talk about some of the particularly problematic areas? Do you have some examples of some of the particularly problematic areas in that curriculum?
Yeah, so in particular...
And there was much shuffling of paper.
Yeah. They've been criticized for having misleading information. So, for example, when they talk about contraception, they only talk about failure rates. Mm-hmm. So when they talk about condoms, they talk about the failure to prevent pregnancy and the failure to prevent STIs. They do not talk about the efficacy, and we know that they are very effective at preventing STDs. And so they withhold information, censor information about contraceptive types. There's one example of a story of a girl who has chlamydia, and they make it sound like within 2 weeks she became violently ill, infertile. They do not mention throughout that scenario that condoms are effective at preventing that particular STD. There's no need about seeing a health professional. There's no information that it's actually curable. And so they, by leaving out important bits of information, in fact, they are censoring and providing misleading information. Another really important piece of this is they often state that the failure rate of abstinence is zero. And we know that to not be true. People, even if people wish and intend to be abstinent, they often fail, right? And so there are some evidence to suggest that those who take the virginity pledges in high schools or in sexual programs actually tend to not use contraception when they do become sexually active. And so in those ways, there is a suggestion of harm, of intent, making it look like abstinence is foolproof, fail-proof, when we know it's not true.
So yeah. If I can try and say that back to you, the comprehensive sex education techniques, say, are judged by this actual measurable sort of failure rate, whereas abstinence is then presented in the ideal state.
That's correct.
All right. I had never thought of that.
Yeah.
That's an absolutely perfect way to put it.
Laura is holding a copy of the Choosing the Best curriculum, and it sounded like she had an example that she wanted to...
Oh, yeah, and Choosing the Best Journey, this is for 9th and 10th graders. They have a page that just says reducing the risk, and it focuses solely on the failure rate of a typical user, and it has a disclaimer that these are the failure rates of people that don't consistently use these methods correctly. And it's just, it's completely designed to put fear in the students and mislead them, saying, look how everything does not work. Why use it in the first place? And I've heard that from friends that have taken this course, past students, that they did not use contraceptives because why bother? They don't work. You're just wasting money on condoms.
Yeah. Andrea, was there something you wanted to add before?
Yeah, and part of that is not unique to Choosing the Best. Part of it goes back to the federal funding and how the federal funding was designed, right? And so it's meant to only promote abstinence until marriage. And so anything that looks like it's not doing that, like talking about contraception, for example, there were some federal guidelines about you wouldn't receive the grant funding if you do talk about contraceptive in any positive light.
Wow. So Andrea, let me ask you, I was looking to try to understand whether sex ed mattered more to certain types of kids, whether kids who are already privileged to have easy access to accurate information, who have parents who can help intervene to help them understand the positive impact of using contraceptives and of other, you know, of consent strategies and the like, if they're somehow less impacted by bad school sex ed, by inaccurate school sex ed. And there's not a ton of data out there. I did see one study about how girls of ethnic minorities sort of had a greater positive impact from comprehensive sex ed. But do you have any thoughts or knowledge about whether sex ed matters more to certain types of kids, whether it's poor kids, rural kids, kids from single parent households, LGBTQ kids? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the weight of the evidence, and again, it's just such a large body of evidence, suggests that comprehensive sex education curricula approaches are indeed effective for males, for females, for all major ethnic groups, for every setting, whether rural and urban. So it works, and it works across the board.
Okay. And before we go to the break, I want to ask you if we can talk briefly about funding. It's my understanding that currently, through Title V, about $50 million a year has been spent on abstinence-only programs, and that in the new budget, in Trump's budget, that has been increased to $75 million a year. In addition, the new budget eliminates the approximately $100 million a year that had been committed to sort of what's called the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program, which grants funds to programs that are evidence-based at reducing teen pregnancy and teen STD and HIV education or acquisition, I'm sorry. So can you talk a little bit about that and about the increase in some other funding?
Yeah, so we have definitely seen that there and expect that there will be increasing federal funding for abstinence-only approaches of the ones that you just mentioned. And even concerning with the teen pregnancy prevention program, which are ending programs and discontinuing funding for programs that we know are effective and work. There's Title X is a national federal program that helps to fund reproductive health, family planning in Georgia and many other places across the country. It's currently, there are new guidelines in order to compete for the funding and for those grant dollars. There is a new emphasis on abstinence-only messages to individuals who are seeking family planning services within that grant mechanism, too. So I don't know, but my personal opinion would be that I would expect more increases in abstinence-only-based education to come.
Okay. And just to be clear, that's being driven, it sounds like, by one person at DHHS who's sort of responsible for that
piece. Yeah, it's certainly at the federal level. There's a Trump appointee, Valerie Huber, who at DHHS, who has control over particularly the Title X funding. She's a strong proponent of abstinence-only based approaches.
Right. Okay. All right. We're going to go to the break and we'll be right back with more.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and you're listening to WREK Atlanta. Music you don't hear on the radio.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge with your host, Karen Landman.
Welcome back. Today, we're talking about how Georgia's sex ed misses the mark and what communities can do about it. I've been speaking with Andrea Swartzen-Druber, a professor at the University of Georgia School of Public Health. And now I'm going to pivot to two residents from Gwinnett County who are joining us today. They are trying to change their county's school system's abstinence-only sex ed curriculum. Jamie Winfrey is a co-founder of Gwinnett Citizens for Comprehensive Sex Education. And Laura Anderson is a 2011 graduate of Gwinnett's Brookwood High School. Thanks so much to both of you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having us.
So Jamie, can you tell me quickly how you got interested in this issue?
Well, first of all, I'm a parent. I have two daughters, 8 years old and 10 years old. I'm also a former educator. I taught high school English for years, and I had students asking me questions in my classes. I saw what poor sex ed did to teenagers at that time. I was teaching a grammar lesson one day, and a student raised her hand and said, if the mother eats something, does the baby eat it too? And I said, wait, what? And she said, well, doesn't the baby choose what it wants to eat out of the mother's stomach? And this was a 16-year-old girl who I knew to be sexually active. Obviously, we're failing her somewhere. Mm-hmm. How I got involved in this particular campaign was my co-founder, Tamara Ashley, her daughter in June of 2017 took this class at Brookwood High School, and she wrote down everything that the presenter was saying and brought the book home. And her older sister was so angry, her older sister had also taken this class, that she made a Facebook post that went viral. I saw it. And I became involved because I did not want my children to have the same experiences that Tamara's children had had. The one thing that really caught my eye was a particular activity that they've been doing for many years in Gwinnett County, which is that the teacher will pass out lifesavers, ask every student to put it in their mouth, then spit it back into the wrapper, put all of the wrapped lifesavers back in the bag, shake it up, and offer it to them. And of course, when the students say, oh, yuck, I don't want that, the teacher says, well, just imagine what it's like to have a sex with a girl who's had sex with other people. And it's always a girl. And as my daughters, my children will never be compared to a chewed up piece of gum or a spit out lifesaver if I have anything to do with it.
Yeah. And Laura, tell me about what drew you to be active on this issue.
Well, I took this program 10 years ago, so I've been through it, and I was on Facebook when I actually saw that post, and the examples that they were talking about were just so egregious, and it kind of brought everything back that I had learned, that I had gone through, and I started to compare how this lesson made me feel and how I actually took it through my younger years of learning relationships and becoming sexually active and how damaging it was. And there was one example in particular that was just very upsetting, and I don't understand how any adult could feel comfortable telling this to kids. But out of the book, there's a page and says, what do you know about date rape? And the example given is, I just got really drunk, and this guy, he wouldn't leave me alone. So he took me out with him and drove out to this field way out east, and he made me have sex with him. He raped me. Well, the discussion questions that follow is, one, was this date rape? Two, what role did alcohol play in the situation? And three, how might this have been prevented? And the Pregnancy Resource Center instructioner posited to the class that this would have never happened if the girl had not been drinking. And that's horrific to say to a bunch of young people. And it's a common theme throughout this book and throughout all of their lessons for the different age groups. It's the girl's responsibility to keep the guy from committing his own personal actions for which he needs to be responsible for, but boys will be boys.
Yeah, that strikes a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
So since Jamie, you first heard about Tamara's daughter's experiences and first took notice of this through Facebook, there have been some efforts to change the curriculum used in Gwinnett County at meetings of both the school's the school district's health advisory committee and of the school board. But as of yet, there's no change in the school board's policy. Is that right?
That's an understatement. Yes, they do not intend to change. What we began with was going to the June school board meeting and presenting about this topic. We were initially met with statements like, that didn't actually happen. The child misunderstood. That's not what's happening in Gwinnett County. And again, when we look at the statements from our petition, we now know that not only is it's happening to students in every school in the county. It's not just an isolated incident. It's not just a particular teacher. It's happening everywhere. We were then given an outline for the process to change the curriculum, and we trusted that we were being given correct information, and so we followed the instructions we were given. We did present to the Gwinnett Community Health Education Advisory Committee. We were told that they would vote on whether or not they thought that we should change. And we put together a very extensive presentation with myself, Dr. Schwartzendruber, Tamara, and Laura Register, who's on the school board in Grady County, who had already had her county switch to a comprehensive sex education curriculum. As soon as we made the presentation, all of a sudden the rules changed, and we were not able to get any information from them about what the people had actually been told in the committee. We then came to find out that we were given an hour to present. The publisher, Choosing the Best, was given 2 hours to present, and that the members of the committee were specifically told, do not speak to each other about this. Do not discuss this. So I'm not sure how you have a vote if you're not able to discuss amongst yourselves the issues that are at hand. The county then insisted that the committee had unanimously voted to keep Choosing the Best. We knew that there had not been an actual vote because we know someone on the committee. And it just kind of went downhill from there. Since December, we've been going to every school board meeting. We've tried every possible approach, from having Andrea give, you know, CDC data, to having at the March meeting, we had the only people who spoke to the school board on our behalf were students who had actually been harmed. Not just went through the program, but been actually harmed by this program. And the school board is completely unmoved by their stories. They continue to say that it is a moral issue. And our stance has been from the beginning, a school's job is not to teach morals, unless it is a private school who says that as part of their mission statement. Public schools should be doing medical and scientific information, and the values and morals should be left to the parents at home and their churches if the child goes there. And you spoke earlier about, what about these students who are not getting this at home? You know, the argument a lot of times is, well, this should be taught at home, but what about the students where it isn't taught at home? And we know that's the majority of the students. Do we withhold from them important information about their health because we have this hopeful belief, as Charlie said? It's unconscionable.
You know, the way you describe it, there's like two levels. There's certainly the question of which way should sex ed be taught and what philosophy should we follow. But then the thing about the vote, it sounds almost conspiratorial.
Absolutely.
And certainly we can guess at that. But do you have any information that points to whether this is a matter of money? Is there anything separate from the values and moral side that you can identify?
I'll be completely honest. There are claw marks all over Choosing the Best from Gwinnett County's hands. We cannot figure out why they are holding on to this particular curriculum. Our ask all along has been, you don't want to switch to comprehensive sex ed right now? That's okay. Let's put together a committee with people on every side of this issue, people who don't want comprehensive sex ed, everybody in the community, religious people, medical people, scientific people, parents, come together, look at our community in particular, and figure out which sex ed curriculum is best for the students and best reflects the values of our particular community. I don't think that's a very strange ask. And instead, at the last school board meeting, they spent 13 minutes on a PowerPoint presentation that was solely aimed at justifying keeping Choosing the Best, in particular, as the curriculum. They won't even listen to reality. Several school board members like to say, well, this is just a case of dueling studies, because there are some very misleading studies out there that claim that abstinence education has, you know, an effect, whereas we have this, you know, avalanche of evidence on the other side showing that comprehensive sex ed actually has the effects that abstinence education claims that it wants, but they're not interested.
You know, and Charlie, you touch on something that that I think is a particularly important point here, that there are stakeholders involved in this conversation. I'd like to talk briefly about what their thoughts are. And by those, I mean sort of the parents, the students, and the teachers involved here. But then there are also some players in this game or in this process that are some of them are a little bit, I mean, I guess I would expect the school board to be a player. They make the policy. But there's also a local church that has become, or not even a local church. I'm not sure if it's a local church. There's a church that's become involved that it's not clear if they're really impacted by the program at all. And then oddly, pregnancy crisis centers have become part of this conversation. Can we talk about all these stakeholders?
Oh, let's do. Crisis pregnancy centers, for those who don't know what a crisis pregnancy center, it's basically a fake clinic that advertises itself. If you've ever driven down the highway and seen a billboard that says pregnant, scared, that's probably for a crisis pregnancy center.
And what does a crisis pregnancy center do? And Andrea has some thoughts on this.
Yeah, too. So it's a nonprofit organization who their mission is to promote childbearing among pregnant people. So their mission is to dissuade people who might be considering abortion from getting an abortion. They've been pretty widely criticized for not being so totally transparent about that mission, of giving the appearance that they are like a comprehensive or more traditional reproductive health clinic, when in fact they don't provide a full range of medical services, of giving the appearance that they might actually provide abortion services when in fact they do not. So there are about 100 centers here in Georgia. Across the country and in Georgia, they are largely affiliated with two national anti-abortion organizations that are faith-based and have policies against promoting contraception as well.
I see. So how did those crisis pregnancy centers become part of this story?
Our understanding is that, first of all, Choosing the Best has been used in Gwinnett County for 18 years. And about 2 years after it was adopted, the local crisis pregnancy center, the Pregnancy Resource Center of Gwinnett, had itself approved, presented to the CHEAT Committee, and was approved as a presenter for the sex ed curriculum. This, again, is a part of a bigger national strategy on the parts of these sorts of organizations. And in order to present the sex ed curriculum in the public schools, as a volunteer for the Pregnancy Resource Center, you had to sign an affidavit that Jesus Christ was your Lord and Savior. Now, I'm a Christian, but that is not appropriate for a public school curriculum. We have separation of church and state for a reason. The most damaging information, the most damaging practices that have been used in conjunction with this curriculum for many years have been those perpetrated by the Pregnancy Resource Center, because that's what they do. They prey on fear. We've been told that some of these presenters, you know, did other activities like pass around a rose and have a boys pull off a petal as it went around the room. And when it got back to a female, say, that's what you look like to your husband if you have sex before marriage. Don't be a petalless flower. It goes everywhere from there to showing very graphic slides of untreated STDs and telling people this is what will happen to you if you have sex. Not talking about condoms or any other way to prevent that from happening, and not talking about that if you get treatment, early treatment for an STD, it will never look like that.
In the last minute before the break, can you also tell us briefly about the involvement of a church in this conversation?
Right. A local Catholic church, a very conservative Catholic church, has put themselves in opposition to us. It's also interesting because they don't, when they come to the school board meetings, they don't speak out for abstinence education. They speak out specifically for Choosing the Best. And based on some things that we've witnessed, we believe that the publisher may actually be backing them in some ways, giving them some of their talking points and so forth. We've read some of their sort of propaganda that they've put out. And I have actually spoken from the podium at school board meetings and said, bring these people into the conversation. Let's all have this conversation together and figure out what's best for everyone. And they're not interested in listening to us. In fact, one of their speakers said at the February board meeting that our goal was to teach ninth graders to have pleasurable sex. And I can tell you, sitting here right now, that is not our goal.
All right. And just before the break, I'll mention in your last comment, you said the CHEAT Committee. And just to clarify for audience members who are not familiar, that is the Health Advisory Committee to the school board in Gwinnett County. We'll go to a break and we'll be right back.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta.
The Underground Recordings, the show that makes you long for shows at the Point, 688. It's every Tuesday at 7 p.m. with those classic Live at Rec performances like this from Drop Sonic from April 15th, 1997. Again, it's the Underground Recordings, and it's every Tuesday at 7 right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
Tune in to Psych Out, Wednesdays from 11 p.m. to midnight on 91.1 FM. Your weekly dose of psychedelia, krautrock, space rock, acid folk, drone, and more. We've got all your needs covered. That's Psych Out, Wednesdays at 11 p.m. on your home for quality, diverse music. WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to the North Avenue Lounge. Today we're talking about how Georgia's sex ed misses the mark and what communities can do about it. I've been speaking with two residents of Gwinnett County who are trying to change their county school system's abstinence-only sex ed curriculum. Jamie Winfrey is a co-founder of Gwinnett Citizens for Comprehensive Sex Education, and Laura Anderson is a 2011 graduate of Brookwood High School. So, Jamie, what are the next steps for GCCSE?
We've sort of decided that we're not going to really get very far with the school board. We've invited each of the school board members to meet with us individually. Only one of them has taken us up on that. And another one did call me, so I appreciated that. But they, as evidenced by that PowerPoint presentation that they spent so much time on justifying keeping the curriculum, they aren't really interested in listening. So our focus is sort of twofold going forward. Instead of addressing the board, we're going to start focusing on parent and child awareness and education. And our attitude at this point is basically like, okay, Gwinnett, if you're not going to do the right thing, we will do it for you. So we plan to have some seminars for parents and students on comprehensive sex education, on how to talk to your children about sex, on how to talk to your children about consent and relationships. We are working on two campaigns right now for two of the school board seats that will go up in November 2018. We are hoping, we know that these two individuals that we're supporting have our issue on their platform. They very much support us, and so we support them. And we're hoping that getting them on the school board is going to make a change. The other three seats are up in 2 years, and something a lot of people don't realize is that the Gwinnett County School Board has been exactly as it is since 2005. The person who, Carol Boyce, who is the member who was put on the board in 2005, is the youngest member of the board. We have one member who has been continually on the Gwinnett County School Board since 1973. And the other four members are all have all been on there at least since the mid-90s. There has been stagnation for many, many years. Additionally, Gwinnett County is the largest and most diverse school district in the state, and we have a 100% white school board that is all over the age of 65. That is not representative of our students or our county, and we want to work to change that.
Right. Yeah. Gwinnett is now 40% white, 25% black, and 20% Hispanic. And it's changing in other ways, too. You know, you earlier showed me a graph showing how national rates of teen pregnancy and STIs are higher than they are in Gwinnett County, but that over the past 18 years or so, the gap between national and Gwinnett's rates have been narrowing.
Not only that, if you look at the exact time period during which Choosing the Best has been adopted in Gwinnett County schools, the chlamydia and gonorrhea infections amongst the teen population in Gwinnett has gone up, what is it, 200%, Andrea?
Yeah, so chlamydia rates, they are converging over time. There was a wider gap in Gwinnett compared to the state, say, in the late 1990s. And those rates today are converging together. So the state as a whole is doing better in terms of their declines than Gwinnett is.
Yeah. And Gwinnett is a metro Atlanta county with resources. So that's particularly a dramatic change.
To the point about parents as well, I mean, our public health evidence shows that, parents are very favorable to a comprehensive approach. There have been studies done on the national level, at county level, at state levels, and across the board, they found very high levels of parental support for topics of sex education, for contraceptives, and skills to prevent prevent STDs and to prevent pregnancy. So on the whole, parents are actually quite supportive, no matter state level, local level, or national level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her saying that really brings up a point that is a larger issue that, seems to be going on in the United States right now, which is sort of this adverse reaction to science and reality and medical evidence. You know, the attitude seems to be that my opinion is just as good as your scientific study. And the reality is that just is not true. We have proof. We know for a fact that this is what gets the best outcomes. Comprehensive sex ed is what gets the best outcomes. But because these people have, for whatever reason, religious or otherwise, this desire to push abstinence on teenagers, they ignore that.
There's also a push to ignore teenagers. I mean, what we've seen in Parkland, Florida, with all these activists coming out, legislators have been kind of pshawing them and saying, oh, are we going to listen to kids now? And when I've gone to the meetings, especially at the March meeting, we had a lot of young people get up and share their stories, and they're pretty heartbreaking stories. And I saw almost no reaction. Parents that got up for the abstinence only that spoke after them completely disregarded their experiences as a one-off situation. They don't know what they need. They don't know what they want, but we do. And we're so far removed from actual reality. And I'm sure all their kids are way past high school, the ones that got up to actually speak towards abstinence. And it just repeatedly seems like the school board, other parents advocating for abstinence-only programs are not listening to the kids themselves. And that's what we really need to do.
Do you think this is something that, like Parkland, could mobilize a lot of local students and a lot of youthful interest and activity?
I'm hoping so. Like, I'm hoping that this is definitely a movement that's taking forward. I think even at that March meeting, there was a girl that stood up and asked the school board, what are you going to do to keep us safe as far as gun control? And she was met with a very dismissive answer from, what is his name?
The superintendent.
The superintendent. I mean, he basically spent a few minutes in his closing arguments preemptively telling her, I'm not going to do anything because gun violence is just kind of part of living in a free society. So,
do you all ever feel like the work that you do is just a component of a culture war that's going on? Do you ever feel sort of subsumed by the connections to all the other things that are happening and changing?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is, like I said, the attitude about science is just indicative of a larger problem. And I think, you know, we are fighting an uphill battle. If you look, you know, at the funding that we were just talking about, they're putting another $25 million towards something we know for a fact does not work. So, yeah, that's extremely frustrating. However, what is heartening is we have yet to speak to a parent, and this is down to a man. We have yet to speak to a parent who was not horrified to find out what was going on in their kids' sex ed classes, what was in these textbooks, and said, what can I do to change this? Literally to a man. We have never spoken to a parent who said, oh, I don't really care about that, or, well, it's not that big a deal. A lot of parents don't know about this, so that parent awareness piece that we're sort of working towards is so important because teenagers don't really go home and talk to their parents. But the ones who have been, those are the parents who've been showing up at the school board meetings in support of us because they're the ones who know how this is affecting their children in real time.
As a fairly new parent, I know that I have been relying on my memory of my public education to sort of be secure in what my kids are going to get into. And as we spoke a little earlier in the show, like I am realizing now that my experience is very individual, right? It probably doesn't exist anymore, even where I had it. So then when I am confronted by a circumstance, I have to rethink my assumptions based on my own experience.
Yeah, we talk about different stakeholders in this process. If you think about it, the comprehensive approach is actually in line with educators' ethical obligations to provide accurate health information, of health information that will last a student, as you say, a lifetime and affect not only their own health, but perhaps their health in their family too. Other stakeholders, the public health community overwhelmingly supports comprehensive sex education approaches, all the major medical groups, and not only supports comprehensive sex education, opposes abstinence-only education as well. Yeah.
I do want to make the point that in several very conservative South Georgia counties, the change has been made due to parental pressure, public health community pressure to change from abstinence-only to comprehensive sex education curricula. So I'm not sure whether, you know, parents aligning themselves with sort of more conservative thought are among the folks that you're talking about being supportive of a comprehensive sex education approach. But I will say that it has happened in other parts of Georgia that we tend to think of as more conservatively leaning.
Yeah, some absolutely are. I've had a long conversation, several long conversations with the superintendent of Grady County. Grady County is where Cairo, Georgia is. It's right over the Florida line in South Georgia. Extremely conservative community. And the superintendent said to me, we had to do this because I had sixth graders coming to school pregnant. We had to do this because it was the right thing to do for our kids. And he did face some backlash. But what they did was have a community meeting, invite the parents in, give them the actual curriculum they would be using. And by the end of that meeting, the parents were saying, this isn't actually going far enough. What you're doing isn't even going far enough, and it's not comprehensive enough. You should add this, that, and the other. And these are South Georgia rural farmers who are saying this.
Yeah. So I'm sure there are some listeners who might be interested in knowing more about the process by which this is happening or not happening. Can you tell me when the next Gwinnett County School Board meeting is?
The school board meetings are always on the third Tuesday of the month, and they take place at the Instructional Resource Center for Gwinnett County Public Schools in Suwanee, Georgia.
Okay. And if people are interested in learning more about your efforts, Jamie and Laura, where can they find more information?
People are very much encouraged to go to our website, www.gwinnettcse.org, or people can go to our Facebook page, and we have a lot of information on our Facebook page. And if you search Gwinnett Citizens for Comprehensive Sex Education, the page will come up.
Okay. Andrea, are there any resources that you recommend for folks who just want to learn more about this issue generally?
Advocates for Youth is a website that has a lot of easy to read but comprehensive information. AshaSexualHealth.org is another really good website that provides a lot of easy to read but useful information about sexual health.
Excellent. Well, thanks to all of you so much for sharing your experiences and all your knowledge with us here today. If you'd like to listen to this episode again or any previous episodes, listeners, you can look up the North Avenue Lounge podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or you can give us a visit at northavenuelounge.com. Thanks so much to our listening audience for joining us today. I'm Karen Landman. You've been listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK 91.1 FM Atlanta.